Words on Water.
Hi, welcome to Words on Water, a podcast from the Water Environment Federation. This is Travis Loop, the host, and this episode I am at the Brookings Institution, and I'm here with Joe Kane. He's a senior research associate and an associate fellow with the Metropolitan Policy Program. Joe, thanks for making some time to chat.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk, Travis.
Yeah, so I'm excited to talk to you today because you do a lot of work on water issues, water infrastructure, water workforce, stormwater, WIFIA, and you kind of have a variety of reports and blogs that you've been a part of that I think the water sector is going to be really interested to hear about. So we've got three or four of these to touch on, and so we'll spend some time on each of them.
Great.
One of the first pieces that jumped out at me was report on water use patterns, and I know the headline was less water, more risk. So could you just talk about kind of what this report looked at and what the major findings were? There were some recommendations too, and yeah, dive into that.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, since I work in the Brookings Metro program here, a lot of our research is not only centered on new quantitative metrics, if you will, but actual engagement, right, with individual regions and getting a better sense of what some of their concerns are, right? Not only in terms of planning and paying for water infrastructure needs, but actually monitoring and measuring them. And so in many places, right, it's a total black box.
Sure.
They do not have a clear sense of, well, what are our water needs? In this case, water use patterns. So
I think it's something that like the private sector, the big companies,
right,
you know, have the resources or they really look at that and analyze it. But this is more kind of for the public sector out there, right?
Right. And, yeah. And so it's definitely speaks to the water folks, if you will, right? So utilities and so on, but also economic development organizations, planners, other researchers. So it's intended to kind of, I think, break free a little bit of that echo chamber sometimes, at least when it comes to water infrastructure issues. And so this report specifically aims to more clearly define and measure what water use even means at a regional level, specifically at a metropolitan level. And so to do so, we look at data from the U.S. Geological Survey to gauge national trends going all the way back to 1950 and going all the way to 2010, which is still somewhat old right now since we're in 2018, but it's the most recent data at least that we have nationally.
Yeah, that's a 60-year span, so that's going to show you something.
Right, right. And so it's trying to get a sense of the here and now as close as we can get at a metropolitan level and at a non-metropolitan level, so we can get beyond some of these anecdotal comparisons, I think. Between what's happening in urban areas versus rural areas versus ex-urban areas and so on. So yeah, I mean, it I would say it's not only quantitative in that sense, but it also lays out, I think, some of the qualitative challenges and opportunities here too. So we know financially, right, in particular, states and localities are bearing a lot of the pressure to maintain their water infrastructure, more than 95% of public spending each year. But then even governing it, right, that many utilities are highly fragmented. Planning for these challenges can be a difficult task in many cases, particularly at a regional level when we think of one water management and so on. So hopefully the data from this report can help better answer some of those regional questions, I think, that are out there.
That's great framing. So what were kind of the major findings when you all dug into all this information?
There are four. I could go on for even more than that, but the top four, if you will, and I'll just tick through them.
Sure.
You know, the first is, and this isn't too new, but I think it's important to repeat, is that there are nearly 355 billion gallons of water used each day in the U.S.
Yeah.
And this is a total that's actually decreased over time. So particularly since the mid-1980s or so, we've seen about an 11% reduction in how much water is actually used across a whole bunch of different categories, right? So in this report, we look at not just total water use and then water use per capita, how efficiently we're using water, but actually, right, how does this look across agriculture? How does this look across thermoelectric power? How does this look across public supply use, including residential use? So,
yeah.
And we're seeing that there's increasingly gains towards efficiency in many places.
Interesting. I mean, 355 billion gallons of water is still a heck of a lot,
yes.
right?
Yes,
and that,
yes.
that should be noted. It's fascinating that there's been an 11% decrease over those couple decades there. Do you know where, what areas kind of led that decrease that,
yeah.
Or rather increase their efficiency the most?
Yes. So we're seeing tremendous reductions, I would say, in that thermoelectric power category. We know that there have been technological gains in particular there. We also have seen some reductions in agricultural water use with more efficient irrigation technologies and so on. But then we are continuing also to see reductions in residential use in many cases too.
Yeah.
Not only because, again, of more efficient appliances and stuff like that, but even just a greater, I think, conservation ethic on the part of many households too. So yeah, I mean, that's all important to bear in mind. And obviously, this is a moving target.
Right.
So what we're seeing even over the past few decades could be changing right now for us as we know it.
Interesting. What else did you find there?
Right. So the second finding, if you will, gets sort of deeper, right, at beyond this national picture of what is happening at a metropolitan level. And we're finding that more efficient water use crucially depends on metro areas where more than 221 billions of gallons of water are used each day. So that's about 63% of the U.S. total.
Okay.
That isn't too surprising, right, when you
sure.
think that a lot of our largest metro areas, be it New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, are the centers of our population economic activity. So in some cases, actually, when we look at these categories, they account for even more of our thermoelectric use, our public supply use, our industrial use, over 75%, actually. So that to me is somewhat interesting, right, as we begin to think of the regional geography, right, thinking of water use.
Yeah. What do you know off the top of your head, what percent of the U.S. population lives in metro areas? Isn't it something like 80%?
Correct. So
yeah.
So this is the key, right, is that even though they are using the most water, if you will, they are actually a lot more efficient in the way they use their water,
yeah.
right? So actually water use in metro areas, so typically it's residential water use, which is actually fairly even from non-metro areas and metro areas. So it's about 89 gallons per day per household. But if you were to aggregate all these different categories together, the thermoelectric, public supply, you know, agriculture, and so on, we find that metro areas use about 840 gallons per capita each day, which is less than one-third the per capita rate of 2,800 gallons per day in more rural parts
yeah.
of the country, which to me, right, it's interesting in the sense
sure.
that, you know, our more populated centers, yes, they're using more water overall, but they're actually a lot more efficient in the way that they're using water versus some of our more rural regions that have much more intensive agricultural
right.
operations.
Yeah, it's not the residential use in the rural
right.
areas. It's that side of the industry and agriculture and so forth.
That's
okay.
right. That's right.
What else? This is good stuff.
Yeah. And so I'd say three following on that is, you know, how is this looking over time? And we're finding that not only are metro areas right now be more efficient in their water use, but they're actually driving or leading the charge toward more efficient water use. So they actually were responsible for more than 90% of the reductions in water use we're seeing across the country
wow,
in the past couple decades.
Yeah, that's incredible. So is that from the thermoelectric sector or, yeah?
Yeah, it's primarily from thermoelectric where you can imagine, right, if there is a large presence of power plants or what you will in a given market, right, that can obviously, if there was a tremendous increase in the technology, right, in the efficiency of that facility or facilities, that can obviously weigh very heavily
sure.
on a given metro area. But we're still, I think, continuing to see, and this kind of gets to the title of the piece, right, in terms of economic risk, we're seeing, you know, on the one hand, it's positive for sustainability, environmental performance, and so on, to be seeing these reductions, right, in water use, and actually can lead to cost savings, too, obviously, in terms of the maintenance of infrastructure and how much water actually needs to flow through our pipes and our facilities and so on. But it also leads to greater unpredictability for many utilities too. And so if they have been relying in the past, right, on continual development, continual increases in water use, right, volumetric charges, then they're going to keep depending on that revenue stream, right, at a time where a lot of our infrastructure is falling into disrepair.
Yeah.
However, what we're seeing, right, is there's this legacy of old infrastructure that needs to be repaired, and there's less money actually coming or less revenue coming from the users, right, who are actually using the water. So this puts utilities in a bit of a constraint, I would think,
sure.
you know, where there's almost this, what's been called a conservation conundrum, right, where utilities, some of them, right, they're realizing, again, gains in efficiency and technology and just sustainability and resilience and so on. But it also leads to real changes in the way they think about their bottom line and financially how to pay for these types of improvements.
And when the, you know, a lot of the funding dollars from the federal level, state level, so forth are you know, not increasing too.
Yeah.
Really a pinch there.
Yep.
And then your fourth finding, let's go into that.
So fourth, and this kind of goes in, I think, to the implications and recs of the piece too, is what's causing this variation, right, at a regional level. And I think a lot of this is intuitive that, as we've already been talking about, a lot of places with higher levels of energy and agricultural production, not surprisingly, are using more water, mm-hmm. not only overall, but on a per capita basis. But what I think is somewhat interesting here, and this gets to the issue of planning and land development and how water is not strictly within the purview of utilities, right? But actually, we found that the more densely developed a market is, and the more, I guess, smart it is in terms of its physical urban footprint, mm-hmm. That can actually lead to reductions in water use. And so when we think of places in at the West in particular, right, where there's sprawling development patterns, golf courses, lush green.
In arid and, places.
Right. Yeah. It, you know, that obviously is going to have a tendency to be correlated with more water use. Mm-hmm. However, in places that are densely planned, are more compact, people may have more, again, more of that conservation ethic. Mm-hmm. We're seeing, I think, gains towards more efficiency in years to come. And so this is not just a challenge and an opportunity, right, for utilities to consider here, mm-hmm. but it's also something for all types of planners, all types of mm-hmm. engineers, economic development officials, political leadership, as mm-hmm. they think of the sustainable growth and efficient growth of their communities. It's certainly something to think about. This report, I think, only scratches the surface of what I think is, again, an issue that's continuing to evolve in many different places. And obviously, you know, more research, better data, is going to be essential to better monitor and gauge these trends in years to come. But I do think that our study, and in addition to other studies that have come out, have pointed to the continued importance, right, of regional action here, that when it comes to planning, when it comes to considering innovative financial tools and mechanisms to pay for improvements, when it comes to technological innovation, right, they're going to be taking the lead here. Mm-hmm. And then if anything, right, as we think of the current federal discourse, they're in more of a role, I think, to build that financial and technical capacity for states and localities to do a lot of the work they're already doing in managing their water. And so I don't think that's anything new, but I think it's an important point that's reflected in this report and some of the other work that we do.
One of the other areas that I was really intrigued to see is a report that looked at stormwater utilities. Mm-hmm. I know our audience will be really interested to hear about that. And so it kind of talked about how as flood risks intensify, stormwater utilities offer a more resilient solution. So for some of our listeners, can you just explain what a stormwater utility is?
This past fall, especially when this piece came out, Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, Maria, was a reminder of how the country, both federally and locally, struggles to manage environmental risk and adapt infrastructure mm-hmm. to future shocks. Mm-hmm. So it's not just recovery, but it's actual adaptation.
And as the climate changes, right. you know, we're going to be seeing more of this, these changes in rainfall and, right. and patterns and intensity
right.
and storms. And
right.
I mean, even in the Northeast, like Boston has had some pretty crazy nor'easters that have led to flooding there. And all that's tide and storm surge. But anyway, the rain is changing.
Yeah, no, totally. No. And so flood risks, you know, to me, are not just limited to severe storms, right? But this is an everyday phenomenon. The ways, what I just mentioned, the ways in which planners, engineers, and other leaders manage and design cities plays a huge part too, which is where stormwater utilities, I think, come into play, particularly when it comes to this issue of impervious surface cover, mm-hmm. right? Whereas we're seeing continued urban development in many markets across the country, particularly rural and exurban areas, mm. that makes it hard for rainfall to literally penetrate
more,
and get absorbed into the natural environment. And so that creates more stormwater for utilities to manage. And that obviously comes with environmental costs. It comes with very real economic costs. And so stormwater utilities, in a nutshell, help municipalities develop more strategic plans and durable revenue sources to actually manage this runoff. And this is typically done by introducing new programs that can be sometimes nested within existing utilities or public works departments. but then also financial tools. So user fees, taxes, and grants in particular that are intended to support green infrastructure projects, mm-hmm, right? So mm-hmm. rain gardens, bioswales, and so on. So distributed assets, I think, that can better manage this stormwater runoff concern.
I know on my water bill I get for my utility, I have a stormwater fee on there that mm-hmm. goes just towards this. Yeah,
absolutely. Yes. And so, I mean, that's all geared towards embracing, right, these alternative forms of low impact development, mm-hmm. right? So given a lot of the impervious surface cover that's already in place or perhaps could be in place, yeah. stormwater utilities are offering a mechanism by which localities can better manage and prepare their physical built environment, right,
yeah.
for these types of concerns.
How does it help with resilience to have a stormwater utility mm-hmm. and to do some of this low-impact development or green infrastructure or just managing stormwater? How does that help?
I think it starts, and it's true, I think, for a lot of our water infrastructure challenges, if you will. It's mm-hmm. it's not so much taking a big swing or a big whack at solving everything at once. There's a huge flood event, or there's, you know, a Katrina, or there's a Sandy, and then the place gets hit, and it's like, well, what can we do mm-hmm. to respond to this? These are more iterative, actionable strategies, forward-looking, in the sense that, well, this is something that we're dealing with more consistently, unpredictably too. Mm-hmm. And so how can we better prepare ourselves to not only plan for these challenges, but actually to pay and do something about them? And so stormwater utilities, to me, are helping regions do that in lieu of, I think, some very serious concerns on what the federal government is or isn't doing here, particularly when it comes to FEMA and other agencies where, yeah. where there's still this model of recovery and disaster relief as opposed to actual adaptation and resilience planning.
It's the old adage about an ounce of prevention being worth right. more than a pound of cure. Did I get that right? I think, yeah. So one of the parts of this talked about a study that Western Kentucky University did on right. stormwater utilities. What did they find there?
Part of the challenge here, not only from the research point of view, but even from practitioners' point of view, right, where they may think, well, this is a great idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we should think about doing this, or maybe we're already doing this. But just like a lot of other water utilities, stormwater utilities can vary widely in their size, their scope, their location. And so it can be difficult to consistently gauge their reach in different markets or even measure what their impact is on infrastructure performance. And so this is why the Western Kentucky study in particular is helpful, because it helps more precisely measure how many stormwater utilities even exist across the country and where they're located. And so according to their 2016 survey, which is what we analyzed for this piece, uh-huh. there were more than 1,583 stormwater utilities across the country, which is
okay.
which is a sizable number, right?
Sure.
But obviously is still somewhat small when you think of just the number of localities across the country and just the scale of the challenge at hand.
And compared to maybe the number of wastewater treatment plants and drinking water
right.
facilities and that type of thing.
Right. And so I'll just point to maybe a couple other data points that are interesting. Here, that many of these stormwater utilities, you know, despite concentrating in urbanized areas, they still remain highly fragmented, mm-hmm. remain relatively new for the most part. So, for example, more than 1,100 of them, or about 75%, have service populations under 50,000 residents each.
Wow.
So yeah. they're still, you know, there are a lot of them. They're emerging, they're growing, but they're still very small and new in a lot of places. And with that, which gets, I think, to this other point that I mentioned earlier, is the case of revenue and actually generating money and support to actually do something to plan for green infrastructure improvements and so on. And so a lot of stormwater utilities are helping to gear up places to take action on this front. But a lot of at least the financial support here is very concentrated in only a few places.
Mm.
So the stormwater utilities that we looked at, they generate more than $2 billion in annual revenue, but $1.7 billion, or 76% of that, is concentrated in just 303 of these utilities
wow.
across just 50 counties.
Yeah,
right.
Probably big markets.
Right. So
yeah.
like Prince George's County, for example, in Maryland is one of the more well-known,
I think,
examples.
Mm-hmm.
There are also many stormwater utilities in Minnesota and other parts of the upper Midwest where they have, I think, certain state level plans in motion, right, to encourage their implementation and
mm-hmm.
adoption.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, right, we're seeing steps in the right direction in the sense of places better planning and paying for their green infrastructure improvements and steps towards resilience. But still, we're very much in the early times here. And then we're going to continue to need to get better data to see how this is developing.
And so hopefully putting out reports like this, sharing this type of data, can help motivate other, you know, right. other jurisdictions to kind of go the same route.
That's
like,
right.
Hey, we need to move this along. We need to do this. Look at the value that there is from an economic standpoint, from a resilience standpoint. So the third report that really caught my eye, and this is something, again, that at the Water Environment Federation that we are keenly focused on, has to do with workforce issues, mm-hmm. has to do with infrastructure jobs, and really jumped out at me that you all took a look at this. Tell me about this report. Tell me about kind of your findings here with infrastructure.
So this research, actually, I started back in 2014. So okay. we're going on about 4 years now. And before coming to Brookings, actually, I worked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
All right.
So I bring more of that economist's perspective here than the pure sort of engineering perspective towards thinking of even the work activities involved here. And so I think particularly following the Recovery Act in 2009, and when there was a lot of focus on shovel-ready projects, short-term construction, that's how a lot of analysts and policymakers thought of infrastructure employment, right? And even today, with potential plans coming from the White House and Congress, is sort of this stimulus spending that's going to generate short-term construction hiring and direct and indirect jobs as a result of that. You know, in reality, we know that infrastructure maintenance, operation, design, and governance is crucial over time and involves many more workers, right, than might be employed in a single construction project, be it on the side of a road or be it in terms of utility system construction. So what we did was looked at all types of industries and occupations involved in not just infrastructure construction, but long-term operation and oversight. So this includes architects and civil engineers, but then also sewer pipe cleaners and electricians. And we found that there are more than 14.5 million infrastructure workers nationally, which is about 11% of the entire U.S. workforce, which is a sizable chunk.
That's significant. Absolutely.
Right.
And just to be clear for people, that's not water infrastructure. That's infrastructure.
That's all infrastructure. Yeah. So that includes transportation, energy, telecommunications, water, and public works. Just
rail and aviation.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
One of the things one of the points that I liked when it talks about the benefits of infrastructure jobs and that was noted in here is about it has a relatively low barrier to entry.
Right.
Right. So at a time when our country is looking to, you know, boost employment opportunities and to bring more people into the workforce, this is a real benefit, right?
So what does that mean,
a relatively low barrier to entry?
Absolutely. So there's 3 points here that I'll make. Yeah. So first is kind of what you're referring to. So, you know, more than 80% of infrastructure workers typically have short to long-term on-the-job training. So they're incredibly skilled at what they do. They need related experience in what they do, but only 12% hold a bachelor's degree or higher. So they generally need less formal education to qualify for these jobs,
yeah.
which as you pointed out, is crucial today when we think of not just jobs, but career pathways people are looking for. But, you know, at the same time, this doesn't necessarily translate into lower wages. Infrastructure workers actually tend to earn more equitable wages compared to workers in all types of occupations nationally. So they actually earn about 30% more at lower income levels in particular. So in particular, workers who are at the 10th and 25th percentile. So entry-level workers that are just kind of starting their careers, they actually are earning more competitive wages, significantly more competitive wages in certain types of jobs here than they would, right, if they went to other jobs, right, in retail or administration, right, that have lower barriers to entry, but they don't pay as competitively as these jobs do, nor do they actually lead to longer term careers.
Gotcha.
And then third is not just, right, that these are accessible jobs that tend to pay more competitive wages, but they actually are expected to grow over the next decade by almost 9%.
So more openings, more opportunities.
Correct. And crucially, as I'm sure you know, there's also a silver tide of retirements, right,
yeah.
hitting a lot of infrastructure employers right now. So not just water utilities, but transit agencies and others. So more than 3 million workers, 3 million of these infrastructure workers will need to be replaced over the next decade.
I mean, that's a huge number.
Right.
Yeah. And we're definitely very familiar with that. And that's now only the second time I've heard this silver tide, silver tsunami phrase. But
right.
obviously it's a new term out there for it. There's opportunities, there's growing opportunities. It's a low barrier to entry. It pays well. And I understand that you are in the midst of some additional research really focused on water infrastructure, water workforce, rather. What are you looking at there?
That's right. So that parallels some of this previous work that looked at the entire infrastructure workforce, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But this looks more directly at those workers who are very directly involved in operating, constructing, designing our drinking water, wastewater, stormwater, green infrastructure facilities across the country. And mm-hmm. so there have been some previous studies, excellent studies, looking at just utility-specific employment, right? And particularly at a regional level, right? Where in the Bay Area in particular, there's been some excellent work trying to gauge what the labor demands are in terms of very specific positions of mm-hmm. need. But this report, I would say, looks not only at the utility workforce, but looks at the entire ecosystem of water jobs. So we know that a lot of workers, especially today, right, they don't simply begin their career in a particular employer, stay there for 30 or 40 years, and then retire.
Yeah.
A lot of workers now, particularly younger workers, prospective workers, which is a huge deal in water infrastructure and all types of infrastructure, they're looking for more nimble, more innovative careers, right, where they may be in an employer for 5 years, but then they may go to another employer in 5 years and then go to another one in 10 years. So anyway, this report, I think, looks not only at those workers that are just within utilities, but actually looking at workers who may be working for contractors, maybe working for other types of employers, mm-hmm. and how they may transition between these different parts of the water sector, mm-hmm. if you will. And so to do that, we're going to be looking at some of the specific occupations at play here. So not just water treatment operators, although they're one of the biggest occupations at play,
mm-hmm.
But also plumbers, pipe layers, civil engineers, and then also administrative workers too. Human resources, right?
Right.
Financial analysts, managers.
Within the water sector.
Right, yeah. Right. And then trying to see, well, what are their wages? What's the training required to fill these types of positions? What's the demographic profile of these workers, where we know many of them are aging, but what's the level of diversity in these positions? How do they reflect or do not reflect the service population, right, that they're actually meeting every day, right? And so that, I think, will be interesting, right? And we'll be coming out with this report in the summer. So definitely happy to keep you in the loop.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'll have to circle back with you when that's out and just spend some time digging into the findings there and get that out via this podcast. That'd be great. One of the last areas I wanted to just kind of briefly touch on has to do with finance and funding for water infrastructure and WIFIA, which is, you know, a really, there's a lot of attention around that mm-hmm. right now. I've talked to people on this podcast from EPA and from utilities about WIFIA and their thoughts on it. But I wanted to kind of just get your perspective from someone that's, you know, outside of the sector, if you will, about WIFIA and why it has good potential and good promise to help.
As much as I've been talking all about local action, right, and what different places are doing, you know, there is still obviously a role to be played, I think, by the federal government via Capitol Hill, but also within individual agencies, including EPA. And so the WIFIA program, or the Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act program, to spell it out.
Thank you. Yeah.
Represents a new type of federal credit assistance program. So that's designed to provide low-cost loans and loan guarantees to eligible borrowers for a whole range, right, of water and wastewater projects across the country. This is similar in some ways to another program that was within USDOT called the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act program, or TIFIA, which has actually helped support a lot of transit projects and others, right, on that side of things. But WIFIA, I think, provides that greater financial flexibility to a wide variety of eligible entities, utilities, municipalities, et cetera, who may lack that capacity, right, to fund water infrastructure upgrades by traditional means, by continually borrowing, by raising rates, for example, by helping cover up to 49% of project costs and targeting large-scale improvements, right? And so this is still nascent. It was only enacted by Congress in 2014, so it's untested in that way. So I think there is some hesitation, right, on the part of perhaps, or even just a lack of awareness on the part of some of those entities who might be eligible for this type of support. And I think there's also concerns of how it will gel with existing federal programs, including, in particular, the state revolving fund.
Sure. Right? So, like you said, it's in the beginning here. I think that they've picked kind of the initial round of projects, and so that process is underway, and so they'll really watch with interest here, and the private sector will, the public sector, and Congress, and everyone will kind of be watching how this goes. And
look, this isn't different really from a lot of the other infrastructure conversations that are happening at the federal level, right? Where there's this at least this interest and an appetite in alternative ways to pay for projects, whether that's publicly driven, privately driven, both remains to be seen. But I think it's helpful, right, to consider all the different tools on the table, that this isn't going to be a catch-all or a solve-all.
It's a piece of the puzzle.
Right, right. And so, you know, look, it's in many ways a pilot. It's very small in terms of total monies, right, relative to the SRFs. The SRFs are in the billions. This is in only the millions. So the issue of scale here is also important to bear in mind. And so it's going to be worth monitoring.
Well, Joe, a bunch of great topics and content here. Very interesting findings. We will make sure that we point people to where they can find this information so they can dig into it a little bit more. I look forward to catching up with you later this summer on the workforce piece. And yeah, thank you so much for your time.
Really appreciate it, Travis. Thanks.
Words on Water.